Badge, badge.
Spoilers for all published books of George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, and all televised episodes of HBO's Game of Thrones. Thou hast been warned.
Night gathers, and now our podcast begins. It shall not end until we're done talking. We are
the princes that were promised.
Welcome to the princes that were promised. It's me, it's Shawnee Wan, and with me via the Skype from Western Nassau County, my colleague, my broadcast partner, my fellow warden of Long Island. It's John. John, how's it going?
Not bad. You can't get any more west than I am. Pretty much you can set foot in Queens in one step.
Yeah, you're pretty far west, bro. John, season 7 is, what is it, 2 weeks now?
2 weeks removed?
Yeah, 2 weeks removed from season 7.
Got about 80 more weeks till season 8, the finale.
And that's a generous guess.
That's just a round off.
Well, let's start with that, man. I mean, there is no official word about anything. The only thing I've really seen is that season 8 is in pre-production, as in scouting and designing sets, building parts of Winterfell that I guess had to be taken down. As far as you know, is there any production or pre-production drawing to a close? Anything going on?
Dothraki Hutt's probably near Winterfell, I think, is the latest thing I heard.
All right. I guess that would make sense. Although, it's going to be kind of cold, I would think.
Yeah, I was thinking about that last few weeks, actually. You kind of hope or think that they're going to bring up some coats and some gloves. But you can't be going to fight in a regular garment.
No, I give up with the gloves. I don't think anybody's ever going to wear gloves, unless they lose a hand. But yeah, they got to do something to prepare for the winter. And if they're not going to do that, I think they need to show some of the characters being like really cold.
Yeah, both Dothraki guys freezing to death or something.
Yeah, bro, we've been talking about winter's coming since the first episode of the series. Winter's been coming. So winter's finally here, and you're going to have, like, Dothrakis walking around with no shirt, no gloves, no problem, setting up huts outside of a castle. And that's the winter that the Starks are afraid of? This winter has to be brutal. Matter of fact, one critique, I mean, I can come up with dozens and dozens of critiques for season 7 if I dig hard enough.
You think?
Yeah, you needed more winter. You needed more winter. That was not winter enough. Even the north, there was snowfall, but no snow falling, I felt. It was almost like a few days after a big winter storm, because the snow looked like it was pretty powdery and fresh, but it wasn't the winter that the Starks make winter out to be. Am I wrong? Don't you think it should have been more severe?
Well, to a degree, they really didn't have a lot of Winterfell this past year. So,
yeah, that's true. They didn't.
And there was really nothing at the wall except for a couple of scenes, and obviously the very last shot, of course. So I guess you can say that there really didn't have to be a lot of snow for the show, because there wasn't a lot of moments for them to show. And in episode 6, you can say, well, it wasn't as stormy because the Night King was controlling the snow and couldn't really just wait in his time to bring the storm because he wanted the dragons to come.
Right. Well, episode 6, I'm okay with Beyond the Wall. I think that north of the wall didn't look any colder or as though the winter conditions were any worse than at any other point in the series that we have been north of the wall. I guess my main complaint is Winterfell, but I'm going to roll that into, I feel like winter should have hit the entire realm. We didn't go to Dorne this season, so that's fine. We went as far south as, I guess Highgarden was as far south as we went. And we did get some snowfall on King's Landing, but that was literally like the second to last shot of the season. I feel like winter should have come. Like when they did the big dragon pit scene in episode 7, I think like a light to moderate snowfall would have done a world of good. Especially with what they were showing to Cersei. To have winter hitting at that point in time. Plus, I know it was a White Walker. But the question has been raised in the books at least, and I'm sure it has in the show also. I think Sam says it, something to the effect of nobody knows if the winter brings the White Walkers or if the White Walkers bring the winter. Or I think they said snow. Nobody knows if the snow brings, if the snow brings them or if they bring the snow. You know, so I think if you had a little bit of a, even just a few snowflakes falling here and there for that Dragon Pit scene, I feel like it would have added a lot of sense of urgency. It would have added, I guess the best way I could put it, it would have been more fearful of what's coming down the pipe because they've had this really long summer and now it's at an end. And by the way, there's an ice zombie also. I mean, I guess that's just dressing, you know, it's window dressing. It doesn't really affect the story all that much, but it's, I feel like it's one of those small things that Benioff and Weiss should have thought about. Am I making a mountain out of a molehill?
A little bit, maybe.
All right.
I don't know.
Fair enough. At the same time, they can't control the weather. You know, they pushed back filming to make sure that they had more of a winter feel. I didn't really see it. That being said, I know when we last spoke about season 7, we were talking about the dragon and the wolf, and I think we both placed season 7 as a whole, not quite at the tier of season 1, season 6, maybe just a rung below season 4, or right around there. Is that still how you feel?
Yeah, I think when I think back to the season, I think a little bit almost like season 5 a little bit. I think when you go back and watch it and look at it, I think you'll appreciate it more.
Okay.
But there's definitely some things in there that just leave you scratch your head a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the traveling being the first and foremost, but everybody's talking about that. You know, it's not something that book snobs noticed and nobody else noticed. Everybody noticed that and everybody complained about that. Do you think that was blown out of proportion a little bit too much? Or do you think that's a fair critique?
I think it's fair. I think it's blown out a little bit. I think the major problem, and I mentioned it on one of our podcasts, and this just always seems to happen with TV shows when it's getting down towards the end. It seems like it gets a lot more criticism than right. It usually does.
Yeah.
And whether that's because I think maybe people feel that they've watched the show enough that they think they know where it's going, and if it doesn't do something to a certain extent that they feel the need that it's not as good, it's losing its luster. I always feel like the ending of a series always gets criticized more.
I think you hit the nail on the head. More people are watching. It's more of an event than it was last season. And it's grown every season. You know it has. I mean, you can look at the viewers and it's obvious that it's grown, but also just listen to the people around you. Listen to the people that you work with. People you meet, people wearing t-shirts. This show has gotten unbelievably popular and it's increased. You know, I can't even say that it's increased any one season to another was a huge dramatic increase. At the end of season 1, the show is averaging upwards of 2 million people. I believe it might have been just under 2 million people per episode were watching Game of Thrones. And it's been word of mouth, because everybody that watches it tells everybody they know that that you need to see it. And this gets to a point where season 7 was 10 million viewers. I don't think one of the episodes went below 10 million viewers. And that's watching it live. Then you have the DVR, you have the repeats, you have repeat viewings. So this is a money-making juggernaut for HBO, and everybody's watching it. It's like the perfect storm for a TV show, because you have hype, and you have a show that, for the most part, I think meets the hype. But you have all these people watching it together with friends, with family. First thing they talk about Monday when they start talking to people is Game of Thrones on Sunday night. So it's become more than a TV show. It's become a weekly event, especially this season with just 7 episodes. It was an event. It was celebrated. It was combed through and dug apart. And I don't know, man. I don't know if this same traveling logistical impossibilities happened in season 2 or season 3. I don't know if it would have been as big a deal as it is with season 7. I mean, they kind of have, right? Because, I mean, Littlefinger has always traveled.
A couple of characters, but for the most part, some of the complaints of previous seasons was that things were taking too long and that there were, you know, it was too much like Pillman time, as I like to say.
Okay.
Now it feels like it's gone too fast. And they, I guess the whole attitude, you just can't please everyone.
You definitely can't. And when a show is reaching these type of viewing numbers, so season one, 2.52 million people was the average per episode. For season two, it jumps up over a million, 3.8. Season three was it wasn't as big a jump, but 4.97 million for season three. And then you get probably the biggest jump to 6.84 million for season four. Really odd. Yeah, totally Red Wedding. Because you get, yeah, everybody that's watching is like, holy shit. And then telling people about it. And people are binging and getting to the Red Wedding. So then everybody's on board for season four. But you want to hear something really odd. Between season four, which averaged 6.84 million per episode, season five averaged 6.88 million per episode. So that's the tiniest jump between season four and season five. And that's going from the season finale for season four, which was The Children?
Yeah.
That was 7.09 million viewers watched The Children, and then 8 million tuned in for The Wars to Come, I think was the season five premiere.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think that has something to do with a slew of maybe book readers who stopped watching after season four because they knew it was getting closer and closer to the show overtaking the books? Or did the leaked four episodes ruin the
that? Oh, I forgot about the leaked episodes. Good point. It may be the leaked episodes. That's a tough one, man, because you have the Red Wedding in season three. As soon as it happened, it was one of the great television moments of all time. And it will always be on any top 10, top five list of craziest thing to ever happen in scripted television, the Red Wedding. So to have that event, of course, you're going to see an increase in viewers. But I'm trying to think in season four, as much as we like it, and we both really do like season four, it may not be the best, but it's probably the most consistent, I would think, in quality. But what big events happened in season four?
Purple Wedding, you know, the Battle of the Wall, Auburn versus the Mountain.
All really cool things, but none of them near a Red Wedding. I mean, maybe for some people, but I think for your average audience, I don't think any of those come anywhere close to the Red Wedding and the Blackwater. As I don't want to say it looks cheap, because it doesn't look cheap, but you can tell that it's on a budget. But at the time when it aired, compared with everything that had come before in Game of Thrones, Blackwater looked really good, and it was an exciting set piece. And you didn't have anything like Blackwater, Red Wedding, or even Baylor.
The Battle of the Wall could be considered the Red with the Blackwater type battle.
I like the Battle of the Wall, I think, better than Blackwater, but I don't think that it delivered as far as holy shit moments. Gren and Pip died, and that definitely raised the stakes, but it was good. I really liked that episode as far as set pieces for the season go, like main, what you remember most about a season, it's up there. But I just, for some reason, it didn't have nearly the impact of the Red Wedding or Blackwater or Baylor Sept. And I don't think the Purple Wedding did either. I think the Purple Wedding, I thought people would be more surprised, and it didn't seem like anybody was surprised. I don't think season four was the problem as to why there wasn't such a huge jump in viewers between from season four to season five. Probably those leaked episodes had a lot to do with it. And season five is when the tough stories take place. And it's where we got into spoiler territory for the books. So I guess, you know, there was a lot of apprehension for the hardcore book readers, you know, who wanted the show to be a straight up word for word like the book. I guess it's a combination of those things, you know? But there's a significant drop, too. If you look at season five, The Wars to Come, 8 million viewers. Episode two drops to 6.8. Episode three, 6.7. Back to 6.8, 6.5, 6.2, 5.4 for episode seven. That must have been fucking...
I think we both rated that episode very low, if I remember correctly.
That has to be Unbowed, Unbroken, right? Was that our lowest episode? But it jumps back up then. Episode 8 was 7. Episode 9, 7.1. And then episode 10, 8.1. I like season 5. I liked it a lot better on my second watch of it. But the first time watching, it was the most disappointed I was from, you know, through the series. Was it same for you, or?
I wouldn't say disappointed.
Yeah, strong word.
Up and down.
It's the most ho-hum I've been about the series. I try to think about weeks when I'm not excited for Game of Thrones airing, and I'd been excited pretty much the entire series, but when season 5 came around, I just wasn't as excited. It was just like, all right, Game of Thrones is on tonight. If I missed it, I'll just watch it tomorrow. No big deal. Upon first viewing, I wasn't enthralled. It didn't capture me for some reason, season 5. The rewatch, it is like night and day for me. I think season 5 is really good. But on that initial viewing, going week to week, and maybe part of it is, again, the leaked episodes, but season 5 was just, I don't know, it wasn't boring, but it wasn't nearly as engaging. I guess my point is, going back to the traveling, Benioff and Weiss have been doing this questionable traveling, and it's never been as big a deal as it is in season 7. So let me ask you this, John. If you're Benioff or if you're Weiss, what would you do to fix the traveling problem for this season? How could they have possibly...
I don't like answering that type of question because it's just, I don't know. I mean, only 7 episodes, there really isn't much...
That's my point.
Really isn't much they could have done.
There's really not.
You were going to get, like, an episode of John and Davos on a boat having conversations while they get the Dragonstone.
Right.
But this wasn't enough episodes. I mean, you would need more episodes or more hours to have fixed all that stuff.
And ultimately, what would the extra episodes and hours be for? Because as much as we like John and Davos, I mean, is that really good television? You know, just an episode of them on the boat just chilling, playing some Sylvester.
And then people be complaining, oh my God, we're 7 years in. I thought this was supposed to be so fast, you know, so action-packed and so fast-packed, and we're watching these people on a boat.
Yeah. It's that situation where you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. You can't win no matter what you do. And I think, you know, with 10 to 12 million viewers per episode, that's just the territory you're in. You're not going to win. So with that in mind, you tell me, were you able to suspend your belief? Were you able to buy into the traveling, or did it have a serious effect on how you felt about the episodes this season, personally?
Looking back on it, there's no effect. I mean, I had some of the problems, I guess, that, you know, might be larger than that, I think. You just have to accept it at this point.
And that's the kind of thing that you can accept. There were a couple times that it was stretching it. Probably, quite possibly, the biggest moment of season 7. It was one of those times that you had to just accept it or kind of stretch the truth in your own head to make it work. And I'm talking about Beyond the Wall when Daenerys shows up. An awesome, awesome scene. That took away from that scene. The traveling. Other than that, I'm okay with it. I can let it go. I can accept it. I understand the tough spot that Benioff and Weiss are in, trying to get all these pieces in place for the final 6 episodes. But I think it was just that one moment where it was just, that's too much. That didn't take away from Beyond the Wall for you?
No, it took away from Beyond the fact that they should have never had that scene with Taryn Tyrion or Taryn said that she was going to go down there.
You mean when she's about to fly off on her dragon?
Yeah, they shouldn't have read that scene.
Okay.
Because then you're thinking, oh my God, did she get it? Is she gonna go down? Is she gonna, you know, is she not gonna, you know, answer the call? And then she shows up, and it's like, oh my God, there she is. It's like you knew she was gonna be there. Like you just knew that she was gonna show up.
Oh, you're talking more the aspect of it taking away from the swerve or the reveal, but the suspense, the hook of that episode, Dany showing up on Drogon and burning the whites. Something everybody's thought about for years is a dragon burning those fucking ice zombies.
Right. It's so funny. I've been waiting for it to happen. Then also when it happens, all of a sudden it's like, if you got there too fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I think it all goes back to the whole entire point of the ending of a series and the people just getting upset for everything.
Yeah, I think it's mostly that. But like I said, man, there are, you know, maybe there's a couple more moments where the traveling is a little bit too much, but I love this show. I love the material, so I'm going to let it go. But yeah, just that moment in particular, it's such a huge, huge moment. And it didn't ruin it. It's still awesome, but it could have been a lot better if the traveling was figured out a little bit better. And you're right, man, that scene before. I think when we talked about that episode, I believe that I was thinking you didn't like that scene because of either the acting or the subject matter, not so much it taking away from the reveal or the
hook. No, it wasn't the acting. It was just the fact that they're pretty much telling the audience that
what's
going
to happen.
Going down, she's going up north to help.
Right. And then we're going to go back to the scene where all of our heroes are in trouble. This one, they're definitely not going to get out of. They're surrounded by zombies. But, oh, wait, Daenerys is coming. We saw her leave. You know, right. We saw her fly off. Marsh, so it's going to be all good.
Marsh, I panic.
See, I thought the scene was, I thought what Tyrion was saying was good. If you die, what happens to us? You know, what happens to me if you die? What, you're all that we have left. You're the only hope. I like that. I like what he's saying. I like Dinklage's acting, but it does kill the reveal. So I guess the two things, they should have put that line somewhere else for a similar conversation where it doesn't ruin that final scene. Not that it's ruined, but it takes away from it. And figure out something else with the travel. Edit the episode differently. Things maybe start getting a little bit weird beyond the wall, and Jon just has a funny feeling. He's like, you know what? We got to keep going, but we need Daenerys, you know, and then they're traveling a little bit more. So the timing makes more sense. You know, you can't really go through the season every single time somebody seemed like they were taking, you know, a hidden subway or a jet plane. You can't fix it all, and it doesn't all need to be fixed, but a few moments probably could have been worked out better. I just feel like episode 6 should have been one of the best of the series. And it's up there. You know, I'm comfortable putting in the top 15, maybe the top 10, but it's definitely not one of the top 5. What do you think?
I think it's in the top 10. It's the top 10 because of just to sit back and think that this is a lot of stuff that we've been waiting for.
Yeah.
You know, you have to cherish that. I can't fault it too much for all the escalation and all that. They did kind of show that it's been at least a day since they were sleeping and all.
Right.
I mean, to have the dragons finally showing up killing whites. As I said before, like, I've been waiting for this for like 7 years.
And yeah.
We're crying about it.
You're right. You're totally right. Listen, let's take a break there, and then we'll come back, and we're going to go through the episodes. So we'll be right back.
This is the Princes That Were Promised podcast. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thepromisedprinces. You can find us on Twitter at @PrincesPromised. You can find us on Tumblr, theprincesthatwerepromised.tumblr.com. You can find essays and images at the Westerosi Companion Papers, theprincesthatwerepromised.wordpress.com. Thank you for listening.
We're back. For all the hype, for all the waiting, for all the obsessing, for all the questions that we thought would be answered, do you think that season 7 as a whole delivered on your expectations for it?
Like a percentage or...
Just overall. I mean, nothing's ever going to meet... If you're excited about something, nothing's ever going to meet the expectations. But are you satisfied with season 7 as much as you thought you would be?
If I got to put that on a scale, just that type of question, I'd give it a 4 out of 5.
Okay.
You know?
You thought it would be better than it was, but that's not taking much of anything away from it. Okay.
Yeah, I thought there had been some marks of the season that would be a little bit better. But overall, it hit all the spots, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't really waste any time.
And in their defense, some of those spots were pretty hard to hit. Especially having no novel to go off of and see how George did it. They had to figure out basically what they had to do with last season and this season, season 6 and season 7. Mostly with season 7, is they had to figure out how to finish this dude's fucking books and adapt them. And it's not
the changes they already made themselves.
Right.
Real quick, I'm sure this is going to turn into a...
Real quick usually means when either one of us say real quick, it's usually...
40 minutes.
Yeah, it's usually...
We're done. Just going around like YouTube and all that, and you can... I almost get the sense that George R. R. Martin is kind of pissed off at the show. And like one of the things he says is, well, you know, I got 20 characters that are still alive that are dead on the show. Well, you know, George, The show couldn't do those 20 characters. Okay? They just could not do... I mean, okay, maybe a couple of them they could.
Yeah.
But I'm sure George is thinking 20 characters. He's thinking, you know, Jane Westerling. You know, characters like that that just don't seem to have too much of an ending.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? He's getting a little bitter, it seems.
It does seem that way. It does definitely seem that way. And you're right, the characters that he's talking about are basically like one of Danny's blood riders. Gren. Pip.
Right.
Obviously
we can sit here all day and say Stannis and...
True. Well, differences between the characters, we can say that.
I'm trying to think of some dead characters in the show that were...
You know, Sir Barristan. Barristan Selmy.
Exactly. Actually, Sir Barristan, I would take it's even more of a loss than Stannis, because I think Sir Barristan would have been a much more helpful unit to the story, helping Dany out with military advice and all.
That's interesting, bro. I don't want to get too deep into the books, but we look at not the Dragonstone episode. Was it the Queen's Justice when Jon finally arrived on Dragonstone and met Dany? And it's Tyrion that's bringing the two of them together. You look at a Dance of Dragons, and Tyrion's not even with Dany yet. So do you think when that time comes, do you think Barristan Selmy is still around in the Winds of Winter and he is helping Dany to accept Jon? And
I was just going to say that I would love to have Barristan to be around with knowing who Jon is. I mean, there is that theory, you know, that Barristan did check up on Jon in the books. So you might know that Jon is Rhaegar's son.
Well, it would make sense.
It would be cool if he was there. And another thing that would be real cool and real quick, I just wish someone was there when Jon and Dany met.
What do you mean by someone?
So that someone like who would know that it was Eddard who didn't want Barry to say, listen, Eddard Stark didn't want you killed. Eddard Stark was, you know, he was upset at Targaryen babes getting killed. He tried to stop Robert from having you and Viserys killed. But no one was there to tell Dany that.
So you're talking about in the Dragonstone throne room. Mm-hmm. And would it be like off to the side or like speaking up?
Well, just like the band between Jon and Dany at the time, like, you know, your grandfather did this. And then like Dany could be saying, yeah, well, your father, you know, when she said your father was friends with the man who wanted to kill me, would be cool right there, like Barry's there and say, listen, you know, pardon my grace, but that's not necessarily true. Lord Eddard Stark was a good man. He didn't want you killed. He took the
He resigned his office.
He resigned his office over what Robert wanted to do, over that.
Right. I think it was Sir Barristan. He did say something to that effect in season 3, maybe? And it was in passing. It wasn't a pivotal scene. And I don't think much came of it. But I do believe that Sir Barristan did say something to that effect, like, you know, Lord Eddard Stark was an honorable man. He didn't approve of your niece and nephew being killed or something to that effect. I might be wrong. But
you sure that was in the books?
No, it was definitely in the books, but I feel like it was in the show too, but I could be wrong. And it doesn't matter because he didn't tell her at a pivotal time. And Dany does have her mindset about Eddard Stark, these preconceived notions that Viserys gave her.
Right.
And she says it.
That was Robert Baratheon's dog.
The usurper's dogs, the Lords Stark and Lannister. Right there, you know, she doesn't really know the whole story because Stark and Lannister
hate each other.
Yeah, Tywin and Ned did not respect one another. And as far as it seems, had a long-standing feud. It seemed like it started before the rebellion. Not that they would have had many words before that. Ned wasn't a lord. But the reputation of Tywin Lannister, the things that he's done, while you can call it good ruling and him knowing how to rule his lands, Ned is not the type of guy that's going to be impressed with the reigns of Castamere.
Right.
They're just opposites. Stark and Lannister. So it shows how little she knows about Westeros when she groups Ned and Tywin together as Robert's dogs.
Right.
As the farthest thing from the truth, Ned was really loyal to Robert, no doubt. But Ned knew who Robert was. And when Robert started to do things that Ned didn't approve of, he made it known.
I'm just thinking right now that maybe, because it's kind of funny, Varys comes in at the end of that scene. So conveniently after, not during the whole entire banter.
You're talking about on the Queen's Justice episode.
Yeah, where they meet. Well, I don't know what episode it was, now it's out of my head. But maybe they're holding off for that till when Dany finds out that Jon is Rhaegar's son and Eddard protected Jon because Jon was a Targaryen. Maybe they're holding off for that then. I mean, that just came to my head right now.
You know what? Eddard Stark, not even knowing that that's what he was doing, did more to protect House Targaryen, to save House Targaryen, did more than any Targaryen from this generation of Targaryens. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rhaegar rode off to war, not knocking Rhaegar, but he also kind of started the war.
Yeah.
And doing the things that he did. And he didn't do them to start a war, obviously. But there's repercussions for every action. And Robert's Rebellion, there were a lot of other factors at play. But that was the shit. What was the guy's name? The assassination that started World War One. The Prussian guy. Shit. Basically, that's the equivalent of what Rhaegar did. Rhaegar running off with Lyanna Stark, marrying her, getting her pregnant, her having a baby. That was like the assassination of that guy that started World War One. Everything was at a boiling point. The Mad King was, he needed to go. People were ready and willing, but they just needed that one thing to happen to kind of justify making moves. And it was real quick, if you think about it. You know, once the word got out that Lyanna was kidnapped, Brandon raced to King's Landing. Once he was captured, everything just starts. It's like the sides were already drawn up. It's like they were waiting for something like this to happen as a reason to go to war with Aerys Targaryen. I'm sure we touched on it in our missing Southern Ambitions episode. And we should go back and really look at both the Southern Ambitions and Robert's Rebellion. I mean, it's always relevant to Game of Thrones and Song of Ice and Fire, but especially now it's relevant to it. Game of Thrones Season 7, Episode 1, Dragonstone, written by Benioff and Weiss, directed by Jeremy Podeswa, who also directed the season finale. Dragonstone had 10.11 million viewers live as it aired. 2.62 million watched on the DVR. And your total at the end of the week, 12.74 million viewers were hyped, excited to watch Dragonstone, ready to go. And at the time, it was the most viewed television episode in the history of Game of Thrones, history of HBO, history of premium cable for that matter. I remember when we talked about Dragonstone, I think we both agreed that it was not a typical season opening episode. Normally, these episodes are like a catch up with everybody, kind of like a little meet and greet, see what everybody's up to, and very rarely does anything major happen in the narrative. Neither one of us felt that way about Dragonstone.
Hype-wise, I thought it kind of failed a little bit. I was expecting a little bit more from that beginning episode.
I think I remember you saying that it wasn't quite what you thought it would be. Looking back now, is it better than what you initially thought, or do you think it's still not quite the oomph that the rest of the season has?
I think it's at the same level as what I remember when I remember first watching it.
You gave it a rating of a 7 out of 10. I gave it a 7.5, but I do remember I wanted to rate it higher, and the reason that I held myself back was I was real confident that we were going to get much better episodes that season. I thought we were going to get classic after classic Game of Thrones episodes. So I was holding back because I didn't want to then end up having to rate everything a 10. And you know what, dude? Looking back still, I really do like Dragonstone. Did Jon and Sansa have a bit of a conflict in Dragonstone? Or did that not start until...
Yeah, no. That was the first episode. That was when little Miss Muffet over there had to speak up and...
challenged Jon's authority.
In front of everyone.
Would you have been okay with her saying those things behind a closed door?
Yes and no. I would not be okay with her. Whatever she does, I would not be okay with.
Anything she says, you just want to take her head off. But
it would be better off if she did it behind closed doors and said, listen, you have to know this man. You have to know how to rule. Blah, blah, blah.
Jon, you're being an idiot. I'm the best. I was trained by Littlefinger. Yeah, calling him out in front of the Northern Lords. I don't know if that necessarily served the purpose it needed to serve. What do you think? Do you think that played well into the conflict she had with Arya? Or do you think that the conflict she had with Arya, whether it's good or bad, like it or not, do you think it really needed her conflict with Jon? Or do you think this is like a storyline that's still going to have to be addressed come season 8?
Maybe it's got to be addressed come season 8. Maybe that's where Arya comes in. I don't know. Because Arya will side with Jon.
Absolutely. As well as she should. Because Sansa is not, you know, she may know how to rule a castle, and I think she'd be, whatever you think of Sansa, I think she'd be a good ruler in the South. I think she'd do very well. But in the North, she's kind of out of her element. She was taught, she picked up a lot of things, so she knows how to rule,
But in a way, the North also later on in the season were like, "Oh, I should have voted for you. We should have kept."
Right.
It was almost as if we're still the South, anyways.
Yeah, it was. But a lot of that was Littlefinger, the Houses of the Vale, and you got to keep in mind, dude. You know, all of the Northern lords that like fucking love Ned, that love the Starks, they all died at the Red Wedding. You know, these are the guys that stayed home for the most part. So just the fact that Jon was able to inspire them when by nature they seem like they're, I don't want to say cowards, but they didn't go fight for Robb. They sent men to fight for Robb. They didn't go to fight for Jon when Jon was going to take back Winterfell from the Boltons. But once Jon wins, then they show up. And these are, I'm just talking about the Northern ones, obviously, not the Lords of the Vale. But these are kind of like the B, C tier fucking, you know, Northern Lords. Like when Pat Riley left the Knicks, and then you get fucking, what's his face? Don Nelson.
Well, no, after Riley, it was Jeff Van Gundy, wasn't it?
No. Went Riley and then Nelson, and then Van Gundy was after Nelson. Because Nelson wasn't around for too long. I think it was only a couple of years. You know, they went to the playoffs, didn't do anything. And then Van Gundy took over. I believe after that, because he had a nice run. I might be wrong. Either way, you know, my point being, it's like, greet John Umbert, you know he's going to war. But Glover, whichever Glover was still there, was obviously the weaker of the Glovers. All those guys could have gone to war. They could have supported Robb more, possibly. But they definitely should have supported John when he was trying to take back Winterfell. My point being is, if it was great John Umber, you know, if it was the guys that were really loyal to the Starks, I feel like they would have been all on board with John from the get-go. Don't you think?
Yeah, and I guess some of that still has to do with Robb still kind of leaving a bad taste in their mouth. Good old Robert Tully.
And Catelyn. That was a fucking dynamic duo right there, bro. Jesus Christ, like the blind leading the blind.
Oh, we gotta do a Catelyn and Chubb podcast. Oh,
yeah, we do, man. It's overdue. Yo, it's overdue. And the repercussions are felt like still.
The repercussions are really up until the Battle of the Bastards, really.
Yeah. Yeah, John had to clean up her fucking mess, man. The fact that people like her character, just it.
What redeeming quality does she have? Okay, outside that she loves her children, but she loves her children, but it's all.
Like, Cersei loves personal. Her children. So what, you know?
Yeah, it's all probably personal gain, though.
Yeah.
No redeemable qualities at all, in my eyes. I mean,
no.
You know, fire away if you want everyone. Fire away.
That's, I think, why I cut Sansa a little bit of slack. Well, definitely more slack than you do. And don't get me wrong, bro. Since we started this podcast, I wouldn't go so far as to say that I was a fan of Sansa, but the things she did, I always chalked up to her age and to innocence. But you've definitely made me look at her differently. And with the things she did in season 7, I'm not a fan of her anymore. And I don't cut her any slack. But I will right now and say she's not Catelyn Tully. That she is not. She may be trying to be Catelyn Tully, but I don't think she's capable of that level of stupidity. Because that's the thing with Catelyn. It's almost like she put no thought into any decision she was making. Because every decision she was making was for herself. It was always a selfish motivation behind it, disguised as love for family and honor of her house. Sansa puts thought into most of the things she does, for the most part. Sometimes she doesn't, but I think for the most part. So whether they're selfish or whether they're good rulings or ideas, she does put thought into them. Whereas Catelyn's just self-destructive, blindly stumbling around like a bull in a china shop, you know, in the dark with a blindfold on. And that's just how she went about Rob's campaign.
One quick thing that I probably mentioned before. I love seeing people on the internet say, how come Ned just couldn't tell Catelyn about Jon and who his mother was?
Ugh.
And I'm just like, are you serious?
What do you think Catelyn would have done with that information?
She
like,
she's sold her own son out. Quickly do you think she would have sold Jon out? How quickly? And people say, what do you mean she sold her own son out? She gave away Rob's biggest bargaining chip in Jaime Lannister.
Yeah, we need to do a Catelyn episode because she was nowhere near season 7 and we're like talking up a storm about her, but rightly so because a lot of the cleanup, a lot of the horrible things that have happened to the Starks are a direct result of decisions made by Catelyn. And if not a direct result, a result in a roundabout way because of a selfish, stupid decision that she made. Going back to Dragonstone, looking back on Dragonstone, What is the one moment of that episode for you? Be it the highlight, be it the most important thing in your opinion, the scene that makes the episode what it is. What do you think is the best part of Dragonstone?
Sort of, though, but it feels like so far away.
Well, so much has happened, bro. That was the thing. And I think that's why season 7 was so engaging. After the fact, whatever we thought about the episode, but while we're watching it, every single episode was engaging. Arya poisons House Frey, White Walkers march to the wall, Bran and Mira meet Dolorous Ed, Jon and Sansa talking about House Umber and Karstark.
The reshaping, the new and improved, in a way, Euron Greyjoy.
Yeah, good call, man. I think that may be what sticks out for me also. Well, I really like the Hound stuff also. Sandor Clegane. I really, really liked his scene also. I could go either way with it. But that was the thing about Dragonstone for me. Definitely didn't think there was any Pillman time. I didn't think it was boring in any way whatsoever. But it wasn't like action-packed excitement. It was just well-written scenes, well-produced scenes, good direction. I felt like it was a lot of meat. You know, I felt like it was a good meal. And it also did a good job at setting up things for the rest of the season. I think what they were going for, Benioff and Weiss, I think they were building up to that final scene with Daenerys arriving on Dragonstone. There was some problems with it for me. Not that big a deal, but stuff like, if you know where she's going to land, why don't you have an army waiting for her? Or Castle's Empty, just have like one dude like hide in wherever he thinks her bedroom's going to be. And then, you know, when she goes to bed, just, you know, kill her. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of, I feel like that's a really good strategic advantage, military advantage that they have. If they're saying they know where she's going to land and that the castle's empty until she gets there. Maybe I'm making, again, a mountain out of a molehill. But I don't think that scene worked out to be what they wanted it to be. I think they wanted that to be like the scene of that episode and,
right,
you know, something
right.
That's getting us all fucking hyped for the next week. And it just,
didn't. She's coming home.
Right. She's finally here. You know, probably Silk was probably like bugging, you know, but other than that, it's like, you know, we knew she was going to get there and we know she's most likely going to, if not win the Iron Throne, come real close to it. That being said, I did like the scene. I liked that there was no dialogue and some good acting by Emilia Clarke exploring her family's ancient seat that she has never been to, except as a baby, so she doesn't remember it. It was executed well in terms of acting, directing, being in the moment in that scene, but what they were going for, it was not, it definitely was not that. Do you have anything else with Dragonstone, my friend?
No, that's pretty much cut and dry episode, you know, in terms of what it showed.
Yeah, I could agree with that. You can't love every episode. You know, you need, if not low points, you do need, you know, like when the roller coaster slows down before it goes for the next loop-de-loop. Stormborn was written by Cogman, actually. I was going to say Benioff and Weiss, but Stormborn episode 2 was written by Brian Cogman, who has been on the Game of Thrones writer's bullpen, which I feel like is just three guys, Benioff, Weiss, and Cogman. I've always liked Cogman's episodes. I think he's a really good writer. And I think that he did a better job with his episode than Benioff and Weiss did. I feel like they should have given Cogman another episode this season. Directed by Mark Mylod, who at this point is a Game of Thrones veteran director. Stormborn did see a drop in live viewers. 10.11 for Dragonstone. We dropped down to 9.27 million viewers for Stormborn, which is still an incredible number. 3.08 watched on the DVR. So in the end, it was basically on par with Dragonstone. 12.37 million viewers watching Stormborn. You rated Stormborn a 9, and I rated it an 8.75. And looking back, I love this episode. I love this episode. I don't know why I gave it an 8.75, but for you to bestow the holy 9, you must love this episode too.
This is the ending with Euron attacking, yep. And this one, Jon decides he's going to go to Dragonstone.
This one ends with the sea battle, which I think it might be my favorite battle of the season. As much as I like Beyond the Wall, this one was just so out of the blue and just, right. You know.
Out of nowhere.
Like, yeah.
You knew those other battles were going to happen. This one just like, shit, is that a ship?
It starts off with, I don't want to say the equivalent of Dragonfire, but Euron got the jump on them.
Yeah.
And I think the only thing that didn't sit well with me on first viewing was how he got the jump on her. Meaning, didn't she have any lookouts? I mean, I know it was a foggy night. I can make argument in my head and I can justify all of it.
Downstairs kissing each other.
Yeah, but what about her other ships, though? You know what I mean?
But they're all kissing each other. I don't know.
Yeah. And her brother with no dick is just watching, you know, just a normal day for the Greyjoys. But she had other ships. So was nobody looking out?
Yeah, that or like the D unit was looking at like, what's that?
Yeah.
I think there's a ship coming. I don't know what this is.
I mean, it was foggy and they probably weren't expecting Euron. I'm sure they had a false sense of security.
Guys, there's a guy with a ship. Looks like our uncle Euron. He's got an axe with him.
Asha, I mean Yara, we got like twice as many boats now. What happened? Other than that, which like I said, I can defend that. I can make that okay in my head. Dude, this episode was so fucking awesome. Daenerys sends the Dornishmen with the Irish fleet to Sunspear. She sends the Unsullied to Casterly Rock. And these are pretty much Tyrion's plans. She wants to use Highgarden and Dorne to place a siege on King's Landing. This is probably the best planned war campaign, even though it didn't come to fruition. It's the best war plan I've seen in the entire series. George will spend an entire chapter writing about strategies and what's going on during the War of the Five Kings. That's something that is generally missing from Game of Thrones. And we got a lot of it here, and it was awesome. I thought it was an awesome plan, even though it didn't work out, obviously. It was an awesome plan. The scene with Dany and Varys, I don't know if I liked that too much initially, but I love it now, looking back. And I think this is our only episode with
Miss... What scene was that now? That was...
When she questions Varys' loyalty.
Oh, that, right. Then Melisandre.
The next episode, we get Melisandre also. But she wasn't in much at all this season.
Well, I think she was pregnant there at the time of filming, so they couldn't really use her too much.
Oh, we get the Grey Worm Missandei sex scene, which was kind of...
Well, she's hot, so...
Yeah, no, she makes up for it, but... Tolman time. Not necessary. We know how they feel about each other.
It's definitely not that one. It seemed like it just kept on going on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
On and
on. Like, the only other sex scene I can think of that was that length is the Robb Stark sex scene with Talissa, whatever her name is. Was Catelyn in that scene?
I don't know.
So watch it. Robb, don't do it that way. No. Turn her over.
I was just thinking of me, I saw it. I was just thinking of one with Bran. You know?
Yeah, Bran's watching.
Bran said, you know, with one of the Sansa's in episode one, he's like, you know, you were beautiful that night. There's all these memes now, like, you know, Lyanna, you were beautiful that night.
Creeper,
next
man.
Season, like, there was one, next season when like, Bran meets Dany when Dany comes up north. I saw you were beautiful that night with my own, with John.
Oh, no. I saw you in the Dothraki Sea with your husband on your first wedding night. That was good, too. Yeah.
You were beautiful.
The highlight for Stormborn, I think it'll be your highlight also, is that final fight on the ship. Shit, what is Yara's
Silence.
The Silence, that's Euron's ship, is the Silence, ship, yeah.
I have no idea.
It's got a name, but I forget. I know Theon's was Sea Bitch, but that's long gone.
Oblivious.
Dumbass. Besides that final scene, what's the highlight of Stormborn for you? Jaime asks Randall Tarly to be Warden of the South. And
loved it. Love the Melisandre stuff.
Melisandre stuff was good. Arya meets Hot Pie again. We get the Hot Pie reunion. She learns about Jon. That was a good scene.
That was a good moment. What was good about that was because she was definitely going to go south until she heard that.
Yeah. Samwell saves Jorah. Jon leaves Sansa in charge and he chokes Littlefinger, telling him to fuck off. Qyburn shows Cersei the fucking scorpion. And that's really it. But with the exception of that sex scene, dude, every single scene in this episode is like a 9 or a 10. Every single scene. This is like meaty, meaty stuff. If you had this stuff in season 2, season 3, this would have been like 4 episodes worth of plot movement. I fucking love Stormborn. I should have rated it higher.
Oh, this just in from Watchers on the Wall. Sorry, breaking news. Game of Thrones to reportedly film multiple season 8 endings to avoid leaks.
Do you like that or no?
I don't know. I guess I do, you know.
It's not the first time a show or a movie has done this. You really don't want that spoiler getting out there. I mean, with all the hacks they've been through, every episode they might have filmed multiple beginnings, middles, and endings for it.
Yeah, that also kind of tells you that the script leaks were definitely fake.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting stuff. But I feel like whatever the ending is, and maybe we have a good idea of it in our imagination, maybe we're really far off. But whatever it is, there's only going to be like one possible ending. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's going to feel right and it's going to be what should happen. And if it's not that, I feel like we'll know it. Does that make sense?
They have something that's really completely dumb. They do like three endings and like two of them are like ludicrous. And one of them is like, so out. I guess it's that one.
Like, yeah, like I don't think they're going to be able to fool anybody with an alternate ending.
Unless they really put out some good alternate endings.
In which case, power to him, man. You know, I wish you'd use some of that creativity for scenes that will never see the light of day for some of your other episodes. It is what it is. Back to Stormborn. If not that last scene, I'd have to say that the highlight would be probably the War Council at Dragonstone or the Jamie Randall scene. How about you?
I'll go with the Jamie Randall scene.
That was really good, man. Really good stuff. Jamie doing the best Tywin Lannister that he can do while Cersei's doing what she thinks is the best Tywin Lannister that she can do. All right, let's take a break there, and we're going to come back with the Queen's Justice. You're listening to The Princes That Were Prophets.
No man can tell them what to do.
The Princes That Were Promised, The Watchers on the Couch, The Wardens of Long Island, The Lords of Chit Chat, Season 7, and the third episode was The Queen's Justice, written by David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, the boys, directed again by Mark Mylod, who had just directed Episode 2, Stormborn. Queen's Justice, 9.25 million viewers on live viewing, 3.08 million watched on DVR, and 12.36 million viewers overall for The Queen's Justice. You, John, gave The Queen's Justice a 9, same score that you gave Stormborn, and I gave The Queen's Justice 9.25. And first thing I think of note with The Queen's Justice is this was like the first episode where I saw some negative feedback in the fandom on the internet. Not as many people liked this episode as I thought would like this episode. You did. You gave it a 9. So you tell me, man. Queen's Justice. Jon arrives at Dragonstone. Daenerys demands his fealty. I mean, that's the story of the Queen's Justice. Jon meeting Daenerys.
Right. But see, I think that just goes back to the whole, it's winding down and people are now seeing all this stuff that, you know, like how can you, like, I don't know, like, get upset with their meeting. It's been set up for so long that they wouldn't meet in some sort of fashion, somehow, some way.
Do you think it's an expectation thing?
Yeah.
I can understand if everybody's excited for season 7. Everybody's excited for the final episode. And that doesn't meet expectations because things like that never do meet expectations. Game of Thrones is a perfect example because of how many viewers it has. Granted, it's a huge part of Game of Thrones. But Jon and Dany meeting is not, I would never have thought that it was something that could be disappointing to people. And if it is disappointing to people, what the fuck were they looking for when these two people met? Like, were they looking for like he just walks in the room, they immediately start having sex? Or were they looking for like, he walks in and he sees a dragon, he just gets on top and starts flying around? Like, what were they expecting out of their initial meeting?
Dare I say these people I don't want to assume what. Could some of them, let's put it this way, can some of them be the hipster community out there mm-hmm. that just insist on anything the show does is going to be different from the books?
Yep,
can they have the mindset that they feel that in the books, Jon and Dany are not going to be all friendly, they're going to be against each other, they're going to be enemies, blah, 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 blah. This is the show doing it this way, the books are going to be different. Although kind of George R. R. Martin pretty much told Alan Taylor pretty much the exact opposite.
And you went into that in depth. When we did the Queen's Justice review, I think it was later on in the season that you talked about that, but what was the gist of that conversation between George Martin and Alan Taylor, just to reiterate?
Well, just that it wasn't even between Alan Taylor and George R. Martin per se. It was just George R. Martin, him being around just the cast, the showrunners, the writers, that pretty much the whole entire crux of the story. Right.
George Martin was basically on set spoiling books that he hasn't written yet for like anybody that's willing to listen.
Anyway, a sixth installment. I leave this on a cliffhanger.
Just so you guys know, I mean, Jon and Dany is really what we've been building towards, and I'm going to write it. You know, you'll see. It'll be in the book. He should not have been allowed to step foot on set. He should have, like, a little phone and when it rings, it's just because HBO, Benioff and Weiss have a question. And other than that, write your book. Another day, another time. Dude, I remember I loved The Queen's Justice. I thought when I first saw it, I thought I liked it better than Stormborn, but I don't. It's pretty high up there. I think for me, it's that ending scene, that fake out, when we thought that Jaime and Randall Tarly were marching on Casterly Rock, which would have been a pretty good plan to abandon the castle and then put the castle under siege. That would have been a good enough plan. This plan is better, where they know where the Unsullied is going to be, and they go to Highgarden then, take it relatively unopposed, get their wealth. This was really like Cersei wins in this episode.
The coolest part for me was when I was watching Jaime talking to Aelena Tyrell and like the whole entire plan transpired. The thought went through my head, like, wait a minute, that was just like what Robb Stark did to him. And as soon as I thought that, all of a sudden, Jaime talks about that.
I know what you're saying. It was just what Robb Stark did to him as far as a fake out, a faint move, like a head game, if you will. Less about military strength and more about military smarts. I feel like Jaime, even though you said he took a step back, and he did, it all has to do with Cersei. That being said, I think Jaime has the most scenes where you see growth in his character. He learns something. He does something differently than he normally would. He's more like the good things about his father than the threats and the complete destructions of houses. And this one is a perfect example of Jaime, like you said, learning his lesson and becoming whatever it is. I guess he's back in the Kingsguard, becoming a better Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, becoming a better war strategist. It was an awesome scene and very little action. There was action, but not all that much. And you know what? I got to give them credit for being able to rein it in, because that would be a perfect time to show a lot of blood and guts, which I'm sure is all HBO thinks the viewers want, is like tits and incest and blood and guts. It wasn't a very violent scene, but it was so powerful. That has to be the highlight, right?
Yes, I'm reading something stupid here right now.
Game of Thrones?
Yeah, fans think Jaime Lannister has already become the prince who was promised. How? I'm not even going to click on it.
Dude, I've never seen any one property or subject have as much clickbait as Game of Thrones does. Every single blog, every single website that covers any sort of entertainment, everything covers Game of Thrones. And everything has a new article every week, which is just a rehash of like old shit. It was called The Queen's Justice because of Cersei getting revenge on Ilaria Sand.
And it's also Dany trying, basically saying that giant, you know, that basically causes a lot to leave.
Dude, a lot of stuff in this episode. Like, a lot of stuff. And we get a pretty good fucking Euron scene, too, as he's parading through King's Landing. Dude, this was a great fucking episode, man. This is a really good episode. It may be better than Stormborn. First three episodes, John. Dragonstone, Stormborn, The Queen's Justice. I thought we were going to get the best season of the series. We talk about the end of season 5 with Hardhome, Mother's Mercy, Dance of Dragons, or all the way around, Dance of Dragons, Mother's Mercy, as being one hell of a 1-2-3 punch. It's not on that level, but it is in other ways. Dragonstone, Stormborn, The Queen's Justice. I was so fucking psyched for the rest of the season. I was psyched for the season to start after those three episodes. It was just amplified by 10. Jorah leaves Old Town to find Daenerys. This spoils the war, right? When he finally catches up with Daenerys.
Yeah. Or actually might even be
Eastwatch. It's Eastwatch.
Yeah, Eastwatch, yep.
As soon as he gets there, he's going off beyond the wall to fucking...
Yeah. I will serve you, Khaleesi.
Dude, you know what's crazy about the Queen's Justice? Jon meets Daenerys, which is another one of these events. Like we said, it's one of these events that people have been waiting on for years. It's not overshadowed, but the episode isn't built around that. And again, I give credit to Benioff and Weiss, and I give credit to Mark Mylod for directing it. It's not like they made it unimportant, but they made the scene in such a way that it does recognize that it's the first meeting. It's an important meeting, but the real important stuff in their relationship is coming down the pike and it grows. And I will say that about the Jon Daenerys in this season. Some people don't like it. They say they have no chemistry. I disagree. I think they have great chemistry.
Complain about how they had no chemistry all season long.
You're not complaining about that, are you?
No, I
I thought they were great. I thought they looked good together. I thought the way they talked to each other, there was not an intimate connection from the moment they met, but there was a obvious connection from the moment they met, and it just grew. The intensity and the power maybe people were looking for in that initial meeting, that comes later on in bits and pieces and grows and gets stronger, just like a real relationship. It's not overshadowed, John meeting Dany for the first time. It's just treated as John meeting Dany for the first time. They don't put any hype into it.
I'm looking at another meme right now.
Jesus.
I love this stuff.
Memes are great when they're well done, but like you could very easily not do a good meme.
It's a picture of Jon Snow like with his mouth open, almost still like a whoa type of thing.
Yeah.
It's like when your dad is your uncle and your aunt is your mom and your girlfriend is your aunt and your grandfather killed your grandfather and your brother is Aegon and so are you.
These are on Reddit?
On my Facebook, and all those.
Okay. That's fucking funny, dude. I'm looking forward to that next season. I would think it's going to be hard to pull off is all the inner turmoil that John's about to go through on top of all the conflict and outer turmoil that's already happening. But him learning not only that he's not a Stark, but all the stuff that comes along with it. I mean, he's not a Stark anyway, he's a Snow. But to learn that the guy he thought was his dad, the guy he looked up to, the guy that he tries harder than anybody else in his family to be like, that's not really his dad. So he's going to have to deal with that. Obviously, all of the other stuff. And I think it'll be an acting challenge for Kit Harington. It would be for anybody. I think he'll do well with it. Tell me if you disagree, but I think that Kit Harington, the actor, has gotten better with each passing season. And not better like he knows the character better, but he's become Jon Snow. When you think of Marlon Brando, you think of Vito Corleone. And when you read The Godfather and you read about Vito Corleone, you immediately think of Marlon Brando. And it's easy because he inhabits that character so well. He takes ownership of it. Kit Harington has fucking done that. And he didn't do it in season one. He didn't do it in season two. He did it slow and steady to the point where he is Jon Snow. It'd be interesting to see or to read about the casting of this show way back when, season one. Do you have anything else to add with the Queen's Justice? Blowing it up like it's the greatest episode ever, but it's a fucking good episode, dude. It really is. And again, there's no fighting. There's no battles. Yes, I gave it 9.25. You gave it a 9, dude.
I give it a 9?
Yeah. That's the high mark until the dragon and the wolf. Uh-oh. We got a meme. We got a meme. Oh, Jesus. What do you got?
This one is a cartoon picture with Bran and John's face. And John saying, have you told anyone else that I'm a Targaryen? And Danny's my aunt. And then it says, no, I thought they should hear it from you first, Aegon. And then John just throws him off the cliff. It's a lot of fun, you know what I'm saying? It's just a bit going off a cliff.
Say what you will about Bran's performance about Isaac Hempstead, right? Everything that surrounds it, you know, the trash.
This past year, these memes have been great all close to him.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you could talk a lot of trash about his performance and character, but, you know, the stuff outside of it, surrounding, the hype stuff, perfect for it. Spoils of War, written by Benioff and Weiss, directed by Matt Shakman, 10.17 million viewers live. 3.76 on the DVR for 13.94 total. And honestly, I thought this episode was a downer shortly after it ended, the more I talked about it. And I stick to my opinion a couple weeks removed. There's stuff about it that I did like, obviously. The main problem, the final battle. And even though I do have all these problems with it, the actual battle, the story of the battle, the editing, shooting of the battle, edge of my seat. It was fucking great stuff while I was watching it. And when it ended in such a disappointing way that it got me starting to rethink the whole battle and then just talking about it. And I just tore so many holes into it and I couldn't help myself. I know you weren't as down as I was about this battle.
I think this, even to a degree where in kind of about the wall, I think it should have been a little bit longer. Almost too quick.
What would you have liked to have seen if it was longer? What else were you looking for exactly? More of the same or like, you know, one thing I liked about it was so chaotic. We didn't know where Randall Tarly and Dick and Tarly were, if they were alive. Mm-hmm. And I think that was part of it. The chaos. Battle of the Bastards was a lot like Saving Private Ryan, that D-Day scene. And this kind of had that feel also, at least as far as the chaos of a battle like that. With fucking dragons and Dothraki. Even all that stuff, which I applaud, the battle just did not work for me. What the fuck was the battle called? The baggage train something like that.
I forgot.
The loot train.
Loot train.
Loot train battle. And a name like that. What are some of your positives about this battle?
The Dothraki in open field.
Yeah. And again, one of those things we've been hearing about as far back as season one, about what that would look like, how crazy that would be. It delivered, right? I mean, it was pretty fucking crazy.
Again, standing up on that horseback, higher angle.
A lot went into this battle. I know it did. And there were a lot of parts, like I said, that I enjoyed. And you take any one piece of this battle, with the exception of literally one or two pieces, important pieces, but you take any other piece of this battle, it's amazing. The production of it from both sides.
I can accept and really enjoy the episode as a whole. I know I was very critical of it. There is one thing this episode I still can't stand, and that's the Arya Brienne scoring fight. That more than the fight kind of bogs me down about this episode.
I bet you if we didn't have that scene, which in many ways is, I mean, for me, in many ways is worse than the Loot Train battle, because it's like no thought was put into it. It's the characters that are killing these things, and how they're not the same characters that we've been with for 6 years. All of a sudden, they're different characters. It's like Mario ate the mushroom to become Super Mario. Like, out of nowhere, totally unexpected. And then it's like they go back to how they've always been. Like roller coaster with the characterizations of some of these people. And Arya, I feel like Arya's just been problematic for Benioff and Weiss since the end of season four. Is there anything that you liked from the House of Black and White?
Not really, no.
For the most part, it was Pillman time just trying to keep Arya around on screen. On another day, we'll talk about coulda, shoulda, wouldas, how the show could have been better by excluding some characters for a string of episodes, possibly a whole season. It would have worked out the timing better, and it would have remained truer to the characters they're adapting. The whole concept they have where you have to get all the popular characters in, if not every single episode, then as many episodes as you possibly can. That's true until like season two, season three. It could have been better as far as the characters if it was approached differently. And that's all I'll say. Spoils of war between those two scenes, the fucking Littlefinger giving Bran the dagger, like, what the fuck are you doing? Yeah, no bueno, man. No bueno. I gave the Spoils of War a 6.25, and I stand by that. You gave it a 7.75. I know you could deal with those things a little bit better than I can, and I do think I'm being a little bit too hard on it, but after those first three episodes, this should have been a climax of those three, and it wasn't. It was kind of like, you know, limping across a finish line, or fucking you're running to beat a world record and somebody hits you in the head with a baseball bat before you finish. Do you want to move on to Eastwatch, or do you have anything else to say with the Spoils of War?
Nah, we move on, I think.
Okay. Eastwatch, episode 5. Interesting, because Eastwatch is written by a gentleman named Dave Hill, and I have no idea off the top of my head where he's from. I think he wrote one other Game of Thrones episode, but it definitely wasn't recent, and it doesn't make sense to me that Cogman's only getting one episode, Benioff and Weiss are getting like 5 episodes, and then this dude's getting one episode. You know, just give it to Cogman. But directed, again, by Matt Shakman, who directed The Spoils of War, and I think he did a much better job at direction on this episode on Eastwatch. Eastwatch, the final numbers, 10.72 million viewers live, which is a little bit more than Spoils of War live. 3.67 on a DVR for a total of 14.41. So again, we have a record-breaking episode of Game of Thrones following the Spoils of War, which, by the way, with the Spoils of War, that was mostly positive reviews from what I saw when it aired. Did you see different? I think most people liked the Spoils of War, which boggles my mind.
I love the Spoils of War.
I don't get that, but anyway, Eastwatch, it cleansed the palate for me. Definitely wasn't amazing. The quality from those first three episodes had dropped with Eastwatch. And that's not knocking it, because I did like it. It was like a slow burn episode. And basically, that's really all it was, John. Preparing us for Beyond the Wall and the Dragon and the Wolf. I liked that we saw Gendry. I liked that Gilly told Samwell that Prince Rhaegar had gotten an annulment and Sam didn't even realize that that's what she said.
I like when Gendry said to Jon, our fathers were best friends.
They most definitely were not. We talked about this off air, and maybe it's worth mentioning, but we talked about it off air in reference to the snow, right? We'll talk about it, I guess, with the dragon and the wolf, but point being is Benioff and Weiss are very talented at visual motifs delivered very subtly that, not that have implications for the series as a whole, but hint at reveals or surprises or truths that we don't know about. They're really good with the subtle hints at that. It's a perfect example of Gendry's saying our fathers were best friends. Yeah, Ned and Robert were best friends, but Ned's not really Jon's dad. It's Rhaegar. So they definitely weren't friends. Benioff and Weiss are good at that stuff. I'm not saying they're master filmmakers, but they're pretty close to that realm of skill level where they could be. I'm real interested in their next series just to see what they've learned from Game of Thrones about running a show and producing something with this much of a budget. Back to Eastwatch, like I said, nothing really of note. No, like, hook. A lot of setup. And I'd like to say the highlight is maybe all of them walking through the wall.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, the gathering team.
Those are the best warriors in fucking Westeros. And somehow they all ended up at the wall together.
The wives with Drogon and Jon pitched Drogon.
Yeah, that was cool. The King's Landing stuff, I really like that. I didn't love it, but I really liked it. Tyrion-Jaime reunion, I thought it could have been better, though it makes more sense why it wasn't when they meet again in episode 7. I love that Gendry had the Warhammer, even though it's lost now.
How's it lost?
They didn't bring it back from the wall, did they?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah. I thought they lost it, my bad.
I think they should have done it. I mean, I'm sure it'll just pop up anyway.
Good stuff in this episode. Really good stuff. But it's all just set up for episode 6. Unless you have something to add to Eastwatch, Beyond the Wall. Looking at it from the outside, they meant for this episode to be the major set piece. The major hook of season 7. Written by Benioff and Weiss and directed by Alan Taylor, who is returning to Game of Thrones for the first time since season 2. I thought that Alan Taylor was the guy. I don't know why I thought he did Blackwater. That was Neil Marshall. If you look at Alan Taylor's episodes in season 1, season 2, there's not a whole lot of big action. Only episode he's directing, and they meant for this to be out of Blackwater, Watchers on the Wall, Battle of the Bastards. They meant for Beyond the Wall to be at that level. Did it meet that level for you, John?
I don't think it was on the same level as the Battle of the Bastards. I thought it was still really good. You know, the environment was definitely awesome.
Yeah. More so than ever before, I felt like they were in danger, including Jon Snow. One thing I didn't like, with the exception of Thoros, nobody dies. Mm-hmm. I like all these characters, I don't want them to die, but when you're talking about stakes, when you're talking about how late in the series we are, you gotta raise the stakes. You gotta start at some point killing off characters that the fans like. And it's been done so many times in the past, it's almost like they're gun-shy to kill off a fan favorite. At this point, when doing so, would raise the stakes so much higher. I don't want to see any of these characters that went beyond the wall die. I don't think it was enough for it to be Viserion. Don't get me wrong, like, that was fucking awesome. But I think that one of the characters, the human beings, I think he needed to die also. And if you can ask me which one, I don't know.
I thought Thorne was going to go take someone from Jon's, like, main, you know.
Because you know he's a character that's probably going to die anyway. And you do it now, maybe Beric takes over Eastwatch for when the wall comes down. But you raise those stakes. Tormund's probably the only guy. Or Beric, but Beric's not, he's not big enough. He's not big enough of a character at this point.
Yeah.
I thought this episode was excellent. Talked about earlier, Tyrion's conversation with Daenerys before she left and how that ruins the ending of it. You're right. Although I will say, giving that reveal away, maybe it's supposed to set up Viserion being taken, a red herring, in a way. Mm-hmm. You knew the Viserion was coming.
Yeah.
Quite a few months back that we read the script leaks. Do you think that scene delivered? Do you think that got the holy shits they meant for it to get?
I think it did, because I just think the emotional from the characters, the actors on set there, like, you know, they were all, like, stunned, because they thought these dragons were invincible. There's nothing to take them down. And all of a sudden, in the first battle of the Night's King, they goes one.
Yeah. That was the first time she saw the Night King, and he kills one of her 3 dragons, which is all she's been able to really hang her hat on. What about the plan, the overall plan, to capture White Walker, to show Cersei?
Again, that was Tyrion's plan. This guy, he is batting 1,000 this year.
He really is, right? Do you buy into these theories that Tyrion is secretly working for House Lannister, not working for House Lannister, but not able to let go subconsciously?
Yeah, I hope not at this point.
Like you said, batting 1,000, some of these decisions, it's like, eesh. At the same time, they're not bad decisions, dude. The war campaign that they planned out, solid. This idea, it's not that it's far-fetched, it just feels like it's a little bit more complicated than it needs to be, but if you're not going to get Cersei to believe what you're talking about, ice zombies, an army of the dead, it's like an old wives' tale, a fairy tale. So to be able to prove that, you're not going to convince Cersei with just your words. You have to show her. So while it does seem clunky, the plan, while it does seem like it's a little too many steps than it needs to be, what's the other option? Do you think this is something George does in the books? I know I've asked you this before, but do you think George is sending a mission beyond the wall to get a white?
I don't know. You know, I'm always the first to say that, you know, all these people who you see, it might not happen like this. There might be some of the battle up north. I don't know. Can this be the battle of the last hero going up north with his 12 companions or something like that? And they just don't want to touch on that. So this.
If Martin's giving them an outline of the ending, maybe he said John and 11 other companions to make for a total of 12 head beyond the wall to get info about the Night King or to challenge the Night King. And maybe it's a lot more of the end game, that scenario, than setting up the end game. And it's possible that Benioff and Weiss just, like they've done the whole series, shuffle things around and are using what's in the outline, a scene that George will write, using it for a different reason and kind of tweaking it. I could see that being the case. But I don't think that George would write about Jon Snow going north to get a white to bring it back to Cersei. Or, as far as the Winds of Winter, Aegon Targaryen. That'd be fucking confusing, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what else about Beyond the Wall.
We had the Arya Sansa a bit.
You see, this is the other part of the problem, is once Arya shows up at Winterfell, you have this really lethargic, boring, disappointing, frustrating storyline of Arya versus Sansa. You know, when you need the Starks to be together, they're at odds. The payoff is really good. The road to get there was not. The payoff wasn't good enough to make up for that rivalry. And then the only other problem with Beyond the Wall, we talked about it earlier on, the time factor, the Raven, Dany showing up at the last minute, Tyrion giving that away through dialogue. These are problematic. They are fairly large problems, but I think the rest of it made up for those things and made it so that if you can't look through it, at least you're willing to give it a try to look through it with Dany showing up and the time factor. A quick break. We're going to come back and wrap this up with the dragon and the wolf. You're listening to The Princes That Were Promised.
You're listening to The Princes That Were Promised, the podcast that tears apart Westeros and sifts through the pieces.
And hello, we are back from the break. I forgot to mention on the last segment, Beyond the Wall, certainly not the record-breaking that we've seen the previous 2 weeks. In fact, it was a bit of a slip from Eastwatch. 10.24 million viewers live, 3.74 million viewers on DVR, for a total of 13.98 million viewers for a Sunday TV show, not the middle of summer, but at the end of summer. When most people are away on vacation, this show is pulling in 13.98 million viewers. And John, I don't want to get off topic too much, but I have to say, if this season had aired in the spring or in the fall, the viewership would have been even higher. What do you think?
Fall, no, because of football. But then again, football's numbers are really getting lower and lower themselves. If you're an NFL executive in order, I think you're quite worried. I think a lot of it has to do with people who appreciate the millions that they make because it's being doing something horrible and just getting over with.
They don't like the players.
Well, they don't like the whole the non kneeling thing. It's really there's a lot of fans that are boycotting.
It's fucking crazy, right? Dude, the NFL was an unstoppable force. As recently as 5-6 years ago, it was unstoppable, the biggest money-making machine, and it still is. It makes tons of money, but how do you fuck that up, dude? Football, when played correctly, football is the greatest sport on earth. I don't know, bro. I don't even give a fuck. Part of it is I'm always working Sunday. I haven't cared that I missed a football game in 2 years, and I don't know, man. The players' behaviors, I don't know what it is, but I personally don't think that it would have had much of an effect on Game of Thrones if it aired in the fall. It might have. I could be wrong. Point being is if you air it at a time when people have to get up and do something on Monday, the ratings will be better. There'll be more hype, more water cooler talk. That being said, these numbers that this season pulled in regularly, it's amazing stuff. And you said yourself, the NFL's numbers are down. For a TV show to be pulling in this viewership, these ratings, in 2017 with TV the way it is, with so many people cutting the cord and going with alternatives to cable. Dude, it's fucking crazy. It's crazy. The Dragon and the Wolf. The finale for season 7, the penultimate season of Game of Thrones. Written by Benioff and Weiss, of course. Who else is going to write the season finale? Directed by Jeremy Padeswa, who we both like very much, and who also directed Dragonstone, the season premiere. And another huge viewership number. 12.07 live viewers. That's the high for the season as far as live viewers. 3.35 million viewers waited for DVR. For a fucking whopping total of 15.44 million viewers for The Dragon and the Wolf. Why is it called The Dragon and the Wolf, John? Especially when there's really no wolf involved.
Well, it's the correlation between John and Danny and their hookup. And then obviously the flashback to Rhaegar and Lyanna. Brew Dragon and the Wolf, because John is a dragon and a wolf. So it means John, Dragon and the Wolf.
Again, man, the double play of words, very, very subtle, and you only pick up on it if you really look closely, but John is the dragon and the wolf. I'm sure it does refer to the Targaryen Stark alliance, but maybe it's more just about John. Fuck, that's fucking interesting, man. I didn't even think of that.
That's basically how it ends with, well, not end, but that episode doesn't end, but like, you know, Sam coming in there saying, you know, that John is the one that's going to lead the battle against the White Walkers, I have no doubt. Which, again, like, right there, is just like them proving any doubt who the Prince of the Promise, it's God and John. If Sam's coming in here telling us at the 18th hour that John is the one that's going to lead them, it's not going to be like, oh, hold on, it's really Jaime.
I was wrong. Bran, remember that time we talked about it? We were both wrong. I know you can see everything, and I'm like the smartest guy who's always right, but we were wrong.
The guy that threw you out the window.
He's the real hero, and you're actually supposed to be a bad guy, so. So where do we start with the Dragon and the Wolf, dude? We did the immediate review. We did an in-depth review. There's so much to talk about with this episode, and I feel like tonight, maybe I've been focusing too much on the things that I didn't like. You know, looking at this season, again, those first three episodes, the best television I've seen all year. And The Spoils of War was such a, for me, a drastic move in the opposite direction. Eastwatch did its best to level things out. And Beyond the Wall was problematic where it shouldn't have been problematic. And I think with The Dragon and the Wolf, it's kind of a similar feeling. The things that I have a problem with are things that I really shouldn't have a problem with. What were your problems with The Dragon and the Wolf?
I think my main problem with The Dragon and the Wolf was I actually had to like some of that Sansa did.
That sucks, dude. Especially yeah. For you. But you know what? I applaud that you're man enough to admit it.
The timing was, you know, what, you're being charged with murder and treason. How do you plead these charges, Lord Baelish? That was all. The timing was awesome.
And you saw it in his face. As soon as she said that, you knew he was a fucking dead man. He knew he was a dead man.
Oh, crap. And that last second, he's like, what do you say? I'm the Lord Protector of the Realm.
When he starts getting desperate.
Yeah. And then Johann Royce is like,
nope.
I don't think so.
Not helping you. Speaking of Johann Royce, how far do you think this went? I don't think they would have told all those other lords that, hey, we're tricking Littlefinger.
Supposedly, it was up until that episode, Sansa was going to have Arya killed. There's a deleted scene with Sansa and Bran. Sansa, before you do anything, I must warn you. I must tell you. I see everything. This is what Peter Baelish has done. Leave Arya alone. Good night.
I wash you when you shower. Sorry. I'm Three-Eyed Raven now. But I'm just chilling here. I'm not really too sure how I'm going to help. But, you know. Listen, the Sansa-Arya thing, that's probably the biggest problem for me with this episode. And it's fine in this episode. And you see the payoff. But the fact that it had been a storyline getting more intense each week, it like held such sway over this episode, particularly the things going on at Winterfell, because it was so fucking frustrating, so irritating, and so right there in your face. And this is really the only thing that they could have done to make up for it. You know, so Sansa was going to kill Arya. What was Arya planning? Like, why did Arya stop with her feud with Sansa? Where was she going to take that? If Sansa's going to kill Arya, then, you know. Was Arya being the bigger person? I really want to see this deleted scene now. I don't want to think that either one wanted to murder the other one. I like it better if it's a plan they came up with when they greeted each other in the crypts. Or shortly after, whenever Arya learned that Littlefinger was there. Plan they came up with. And they were having this feud. to keep up appearances, to catch Littlefinger. That's what I want to believe. But the problem with that is then, if Sansa was going to do this since fucking episode 4 or whatever, why then even fucking help Littlefinger? Why bring Littlefinger to Winterfell? Why not just, you know what I mean? Like, then she must have already known that he was doing this stuff. So it's Bran that saw it. Arya can confirm some of it. And suddenly they get along and they're going to trick Littlefinger. I don't know, dude. That said, the trial part was sick. The timing was beautiful. The acting all around was great. Aidan Gillian is one of the actors in Game of Thrones that went underrated. He should have been noticed more. And looking back on that character's, that version of Littlefinger and his storyline, it's better than what I thought it was. Not as good as the book, obviously, but it's good. I think they did the best they could with Littlefinger. That's really my main problem with The Dragon and the Wolf. I loved the Dragon Pit meeting. Did that meet your expectations, John?
I thought it was a little bit different. I thought there's going to be more bystanders, more just common people involved in it. Somehow, for some reason, I thought it was just going to be a little more grander.
So you thought, like, maybe more southern lords? The lords sworn to King's Landing?
I just thought there was just going to be, like, a larger scale of people would be there. I'm going to say, like, a nobodies.
Spectators.
Really? Yeah. I don't know why I thought that. I could probably, that thought, you know, probably dead wrong not thinking on that, but that's just how I anticipated
it. It would have added a certain level of epic to what was already an unbelievably epic meeting. The King in the North, Queen in Seven Kingdoms, the would-be usurper or former queen who deserves the Iron Throne, whatever you want to call her, they're all in one place together. And just the fact that they would trust Cersei after what she did at fucking Baelor's Sept is crazy. That's crazy. Maybe having all those people there, I think, would have taken away from that apprehension you had of, like,
Is
she going to do something crazy? She could. She has in the past. I thought this was the best Lena Headey we had this season. And not she did any bad performances, but when you say that you think she's doing Aegon Targaryen's storyline, I think you're right. And I think that they're...
Aegon is going to be Dany's...
opposition for the Iron Throne.
Opposition.
Yeah.
And that's why it makes things even more interesting that Jon's name is also Aegon, because then she'll meet the real Aegon that will be by her side.
My nephew's Aegon, my other nephew's Aegon, their brothers. Marry one of them.
Well, I think in the book, I think Aegon's going to be marrying Mary and Martell.
That would make more sense and get the Martells involved. It would explain the absence of Arryn Martell, other than, obviously, you know, time constraints.
Khaleesi told me if there was characters you talk about that, you know, that were omitted that should be in. I think with Fagin, I think with him, you have to bring in, you know, John Connor, you have to bring in Arryn Martell. Bring in any of those, you're not going to bring in one of them.
You can say the same for Quentin also. You bring in Quentin.
Yeah.
The whole purpose of Quentin was to offer Daenerys the marriage pact that he would have offered Viserys. Or not offered, it was a done deal.
Yeah. Viserys would marry Arryn, and then Dany would marry Quentin.
Uh-huh. Actually, I don't know if that was part of the original deal, but that's kind of like the substitution that Dorne came up with once he found out that Viserys was dead. Yeah, and then they thought that it was Daenerys that killed her brother. It's an interesting storyline. It really is, but if you include one, you're doing it kind of half-heartedly. And it's already kind of half-hearted the way they had Dorne set up. You needed to include Oberyn Martell. The character's too interesting, too good of a character to not include. But then you got to pick and choose, and it's tough. But with Cersei this season, and it's not that she has a lack of scenes, a lack of lines, and it's not like they're forced, the ones that are there. But yeah, I think I'm with you. It's not a direction that George is going to go in. And it'll definitely play out differently in The Winds of Winter.
And just another many of the reasons why Fagin is not in the show is, in my eyes, is just the fact that Jon's name is also Aegon, and you just don't want to confuse anyone. I also want to make clear again, I'll say once again, season 3, the Brotherhood Without Banners mentions Aegon Targaryen, so it's not like they're just giving Jon the name Aegon, taking Aegon's name. They mention the name Aegon, as in Elia's son Aegon. Believe you me, they mention Aegon.
But not just that, so you're saying that they don't mention it in many other episodes. So when they talk about killing Elia Martell's, they just say the children, or what? They don't?
They murder their children, yes. That's it. They don't mention it. But in season 3, they mention his name.
Okay. Do you remember what it was framed as when they mentioned his name? Like, was it part of the prince that was promised? Was it part of Azor Ahai return?
No, not at all.
Nothing like that.
I think they mentioned, if my memory serves me correct, they mentioned it when they're taking the Hound down.
When they're doing the tribe-like combat? Oh, because they're blaming. Yeah. Because they were kind of laying those murders at his feet.
Right.
Saying you're Tywin Lannister's dog. You killed Aegon Targaryen and Rhaella.
Yeah.
It wasn't me. It was my brother.
I have YouTube on right now, so you can hear background noise. That's what it is. I'm just trying to get to this.
Okay, yeah.
I think this is what.
Yeah, I can't hear it, dude. Did you find it?
Not yet. Hold on. Okay. It might be coming up.
Okay.
There you go. Season 3, Episode 4. Beric Dondarrion is the Thoros Amir. Says.
House Clegane.
Was built on murdering Sojin.
I saw them lay Prince Aegon and Princess Rhaenys.
Yep. So, please, there you go. Aegon with Rhaegar and Elliot was mentioned. I've seen that post numerous times already that they haven't mentioned his name because they gave the name to Jon. Nope. They mentioned his name.
And that was which episode?
Episode 4. Season 3, Episode 4. Okay. It was right when Beric Dondarrion is introduced to the Hound. A couple minutes after their introduction.
And now his watch has ended. Yes. This is the name of the episode. Yep. Gior. Good old Gior Mormont.
Yeah.
Did you see Wonder Woman? He was in Wonder Woman. Briefly.
No, I didn't see it, no.
It's pretty good.
I'm in love with
my God, dude.
She could have been Arya Martell almost. She almost been there. There's anyone who would be Arya Martell, she would have been kind of close. I would still probably be disappointed.
That's a perfect segue into expectations versus reality. And the spot that Game of Thrones is in now. And it's funny because getting introduced to characters not being involved, that used to be the disappointment. Your expectation is you're going to get to see House Martell, and the reality is a disappointment, and you see only half of them. It's not about that anymore. Now it's about
the end game.
The end game, the story, the battles, the bigger stuff. And it's only now that there are so many fucking people watching this show every week that we've gotten here. As far as the dragon and the wolf, I spoke about what I don't like. You and me, we both love the Jaime scene with Cersei. I think that's great.
Great scene. Second best scene of that episode.
I know your favorite is the intercutting scene, past and present.
Yeah, I mean, the more I watch that scene, there was a sex scene going on.
Yeah.
I just love, he's never been a bastard. He's the heir to the Iron Throne. And I've gone against my own wording here. I've been calling John, I should be calling him Aegon. Once again, I do honestly feel his name will be Aegon in the books. I just don't think.
No, I think it's something big that they wouldn't change from George's outline.
Like, I'm sure they'd be like, wait a minute, okay, so now John, you know, you're, okay, George, so you got your answer right that John is Rhaegar Lyanna's. All right, anything else? Oh, yeah, his name is Aegon also. And I texted you today, I've seen some people brought up.
You're saying, what if Lyanna?
Lyanna just named him Aegon, knowing that Rhaegar is so knee deep into this. Prince that was promised, one son meaning Aegon, he made a mistake with Aegon, and then went, well, I got another boy. It's my boy. We'll name him Aegon. That's just a possibility.
You know what, dude? That makes a little bit more sense that it's Lyanna's decision. In terms of Rhaegar and in terms of what he felt about prophecy and what his role was in the bigger scheme of things, I understand it, but it's still kind of hard to believe that any guy would name two of his sons the same name. So if it's something that Lyanna decides on because she knows how Rhaegar feels, if she believes in what Rhaegar believes in, then it makes more sense, I think.
Did I, in the review, I think I did I bring up the whole Maester Aemon kill the boy part?
You started on it, yeah.
It's convenient that the only two people he's told that to is his brother Aegon.
Right.
And then it looks like his great-great-nephew Aegon.
Yeah.
That is another thing that goes hand-in-hand with his name being really Aegon. I haven't completely seen it yet, but I'm sure I'll get the hipsters saying that this is just, you know, the show's version and it's going to be completely different.
They're just faking us out. They don't even know it. George just told them a lie, you know, just to throw them off.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you want to hear one good one? This was a real good one. And it's just so funny because obviously at the time I heard this, I already knew about the leaks for season 7. Firm believer that John is not Rhaegar Lyanna's son. I think he actually thinks that Ned married someone else. Like, so unconsequential to the story it's just completely ludicrous.
This is somebody like way south where you would like never be able to see her. Exactly. It's just for the hell of it, just to make it more confusing.
It's just really stupid. But he was saying that I know last year that Bran, you see the Bran reveal, but I think it's going to be a mistake. We're going to find out that Bran saw that and it was actually a mistake, that it wasn't John or something like that. I'm like, what? But they show it right after the thing, the baby switch right to John.
Is he implying that Ned really does have a bastard, or?
He's just implying that what we saw last year in season 6 was false information, was fake news. It wasn't really John, just Bran makes a mistake and thinks that it's John. It's just stupid. It's just stupid.
How that could possibly be of any entertainment or emotional value to anybody that's been watching the show this far or reading the books, it's like they've never read a different book or they've never seen a movie. They have no concept of what Western storytelling is. It's really rather frustrating to think that people like that exist and like they're literally trolling the entire fandom. It's like they don't like it, but every week they're like watching it intensely, and I have no respect for that stuff, dude. No respect for that stuff. You get no respect. No respect at all. Though Jeremy Podesta was directing in this episode was fucking top-notch. I do like all the setups for season 8. I do wish a little more was resolved in season 7, though. I think we got a meme. We've got a meme, ladies and gentlemen.
It's a picture of Rhaegar and Lyanna's wedding, and Rhaegar saying, "Do you think we should tell our families?" And Lyanna says, "Not let anyone kill each other."
That's perfect.
Well, the one thing I wanted to mention real quick, you know, the scene when we see the snow hitting King's Landing and Jaime running off, and you know, the snow meaning that winter's coming to King's Landing, that definitely seemed like this war is going to come to King's Landing. This great war, the Great War of the Dawn. And the very next scene we see Samwell coming up to Winterfell, telling Bran that he believes he's going to be a leader in the war. True name, he's legitimate. It's just something that the D&D put in there right after we show what could become, and then you show the person who's going to lead. You know, you show both sides.
What could become in terms of?
You see the snow representing the darkness, the Night's King. Then the next scene showing the son of power marriage, you know.
Yeah.
That is the leader against that, you know, back in back-to-back scenes.
Beginning with Jaime walking out on his sister, riding away from King's Landing, he sees the snowfall. Like you said before, snowfall on King's Landing. The Red Keep is located there. The Iron Throne is located in the Red Keep inside Maegar's Holdfast. And then we go to the reveal. Jon's best friend and most trusted ally and Jon's half-brother, who, safe to say, he looked up to Jon growing up. Bran and Arya were the two Starks. Rickon not because he was too young, but those are the two that most accepted Jon as a big brother.
And it seems like Bran's really excited. He wants to tell Jon that, you know, he needs, you're the heir to the Iron Throne. And he wants Jon to take this, that he deserves to have this throne.
So we cut to that scene of them, between the two of them, figuring out the full picture, the full scope of who Jon really is. You think about the Targaryen marriages throughout history. Since Aegon conquered Westeros, Targaryens marry Targaryens. And if they're marrying houses outside of their own, they marry the Martells to secure Dorne. They tried to conquer Dorne and they couldn't do it. I should know off the top of my head, but I don't, which Targaryen king it was that got Dorne into the Seven Kingdoms by marrying into it. But other than Martells, you know, they've married Valyrians in the past, but Valyrians are Valyrian, the blood of old Valyria. So they must have been doing that back in Valyria. I'm trying to think of some other houses that the Targaryens have married into.
Baratheon.
Yeah, Baratheon. Robert's considered a cousin to Rhaegar. Mm-hmm. And then Blackwoods and Brackens, it was really just Aegon the Unworthy that messed around with the Brackens and the Blackwoods of the Riverlands. My point being, for Rhaegar to marry someone that's not a Martell and not of his own blood, his sister or some shit, for Rhaegar to do that, that's a big fucking deal, especially a house in the north. So you talk about the southern ambitions and Rickard Stark's plan for all these great houses to marry together to provide them a full realm-wide alliance so they have some power over the Mad King. You get that right here with Rhaegar and Lyanna, done in secret. The ancient House Stark and the blood of Valyria, the Targaryens, the dragon and the wolf, Rhaegar Targaryen and Lyanna Stark. Every time you look at this, call it R plus L equals J, call it the relationship of Rhaegar and Lyanna, Jon's heritage, whatever you want to call this part of the story, this is the main mystery, the main thing that you have faith in, that you believe in when you read this story. not so much with the visual motifs of Game of Thrones, but George's writing, all the different levels that make up Rhaegar and Lyanna, and what happened because of them, why they did what they did in the first place. They did what they did in the first place. Rhaegar did it. He believes in Azor Ahai. He knows the others are coming. The White Walkers are coming, and they're going to have to fight for the Dawn again, and he knows that he plays a part in it. He's not the prince that was promised, but it comes from his line. He has a duty to the realm to do this. It's not just true love that he married her. It's because he thought it was the right thing to save the realm. And in fact, what ends up happening is the realm descends into fucking chaos. Chaos, mind you, that is never really put back together. Balon Greyjoy takes advantage of the chaos as best he can. But by the time of Robert's death, the realm is already torn apart and it's being held together by stitches, hanging on by a thread by the time Robert dies. And maybe it was like that with the Targaryens as rulers, but they had dragons, so nobody fucked around on them. Who knows? We only have the World of Ice and Fire to go off of. But my point being is this secret marriage, what looked like a kidnapping, one of the major factors in Robert's rebellion, the war that followed, all the people that died. Was it the reason, like the full reason for this? No, it wasn't. The reasons were already in place. It was going to happen. If it wasn't Rhaegar and Lyanna, something else would have happened. Because Aerys had to go because he was a fucking nut job. And he was dangerous. Point being, the dragon and the wolf, it does Rhaegar and Lyanna and everything that that means. It does it justice. It's impossible to meet our expectations. Impossible for it to exceed our expectations. Because our expectations, we've been thinking about this. In particular, just this theory, this idea. Since we started reading A Game of Thrones. I'll be interested to see how deep they go in season 8. I have a feeling they're not going to go super deep, but we can go there on our own in our mind because there's that many different fucking layers to it. What you said before about the snow falling at King's Landing, you can come up with a bunch of visual motifs that for a bunch of things that that represents. Snow falling at King's Landing, Jon Snow is going to come to King's Landing and he's going to sit on the Iron Throne. It can be implied as so many different things. R plus L equals J is at the heart of everything. All of these relationships, these wars, they have very little meaning without R plus L equals J.
And I liked how they did the whole entire, you know, reveal the marriage, then John and Danny having sex without them even realizing that they're, you know, related at all.
Well, I think at this point, like, there's been so much incest on this show that it loses its shock value. Not so much Danny, but definitely John will be. Yeah. Bothered by this, and Danny's be like, nah, dude, yeah, it's cool. That's how we roll, man. We're Targaryens. Don't worry about it. And I can't have kids anyway. I think it was implied that she's pregnant. You know, that
she's definitely, yeah. Whether because of that night, they're definitely going to have a kid. It's,
yeah.
They beat it around the subject long enough, especially that episode. John said, oh, you believe this woman?
And I never thought of that either. Like, why would you believe her? Just because you lost one baby doesn't mean you can't have a baby again. Beyond the Wall, you gave a 9. I gave it an 8.5. The Dragon and the Wolf, we both gave it the season high mark, 9.5 from both of us. It wasn't the Winds of Winter from last season. I wasn't expecting another Winds of Winter, but it was up there. Okay, so Lord of Lightning round, the 7 episodes of season 7. Your favorite to your least favorite in order.
Okay, Dragon and the Wolf. Queen's Justice, Beyond the Wall, Stormborn, Eastwatch, Spoils of War,
All right. And
Dragonstone.
Wow. And what is it about Dragonstone that it doesn't...
It was a setup. You know, they set the pieces up where everyone was going. Still good, but I just, you know, I just wanted to, you know, rank it until the end.
Yeah.
At least rank.
Good stuff, John. No, at this point he is, yeah. Like, you want to be on the Mets, like I'm sure they'll let you be a coach, bro, but, like, you're hindering any improvements that they can make.
$17 million that they could be spending on other ball players that could perform.
Well, could perform until they actually get to Citi Field and stop performing, but that's another story. All right, the best performance, actor or actress, for season 7.
You know what I'm going to say? Actor or actress. I'm going to say Kit Harington.
Nice, John. Some people could say that you're just saying that because you're a Jon Snow mark, but
but I've never said Katana has been the best.
You haven't.
It's not like I go, oh, he's so, never seen the greatest actor in all of the show.
And you know what? If you said that for, like I was talking about before, with Kit Harington's improvement each season, if you said that in season three, season two, I'd be like, dude, you're just saying that because he's your favorite.
Yeah.
But he has gotten better with each season. And this season, he has become the main character of the show. Game of Thrones is approaching it as Jon, then Dany and Tyrion. And I think the true test for how well he knows his character, for how good of an actor he is, will be next season when he learns this same truth and how his character presses on with the things he's got to do. And that'll be a challenge for Kit Harington. It's also going to be a challenge for Benioff and Weiss and how they're able to write that.
You know, I just had to step in and make sure that they were on the right path. Hmm. Playing for so long with these two ancestral lovebirds.
I got a new movie playing at the Cacto Cinema, but I had to fly over here. And, you know, while I'm here, I'm going to check out the local pizza. Maybe hit up a convention, the science fiction book convention.
And D&D have talked about possibly me writing the last two episodes. I'm very excited about that.
I'm going to start researching my books to write these episodes. You know, and I have plenty of time. They're not airing for another year, year and a half. Of course, the football. The Jets. We got to watch every Jet game start to finish. Have to. Got to do it. Dude, for that reason alone, I wish the NFL would just go out of business. We get a fucking book. Can they go on strike? Can they do that? Like,
they can. Yeah.
Is there a collective bargaining agreement coming to an end?
I'm shocked. In a way, I do feel bad for football players with all the physical contracts aren't guaranteed. You go to baseball and they like guarantee $40 million in your contract starting up pretty soon. It's just like,
Bonilla's still getting paid for the Mets.
You're running bases pretty much. You're hitting a ball on a running basis. You stick on playing
catch. Yeah. With football, you're putting your body on the line and
your life on the line pretty much.
If they went on strike, that would be the best thing that could fucking happen to us, bro. Because doesn't go out of business, you know it's coming back, and the dude is going to just write on Sundays instead of watching football. He'll be an NBA fan then, is what'll happen. He'll love the NBA as much as he loves the NFL. Just be talking about fucking, like, the Knicks all the time, or like the fucking, I don't even fucking know what team is out there by him, the Phoenix Suns. Lord of Lightning Round. John, what happened to Ramin Djawadi this season?
He was definitely a little off. I think there's a couple of good ones in there. I think the last episode had some good.
Was it him or was there no memorable scene?
There was a memorable scene that just maybe we're not, you know, maybe he expected too much. Maybe we thought, you know, this is going to be iconic. And
maybe they fire him and John Williams comes in to do. Which is like a slightly different version of the Star Wars dude.
He does Across the Stars for Johnny.
Game of Thrones. Season 8, Episode 1. The White Walkers.
George Lucas.
Oh, my God. Produced by Rick McCallum. Imagine.
I love it.
I love it, too, bro. Colin Trevorrow. How are you feeling about Colin Trevorrow being fired from Ep 9?
But why was he fired? Because he just couldn't get away.
There's got to be more to the story, dude. But Kathleen Kennedy is like,
that's why I didn't want to bother reading, because I just guarantee it's going to be a he said, she said type thing.
He did Jurassic World, which was great. And he did like a indie movie before it, which apparently was really, really good. And that's kind of what his claim to fame was. And he had this passion project. I forget the name of the movie, but he had this passion project, which was like fucking god-awful, apparently. And it was a recent movie. So they're thinking that, you know, you put Jurassic on any movie and you're going to get like $400 million just because it's called Jurassic Park or Jurassic World, whether it's good or not. And it was good, but it was good mostly because of the nostalgia factor. Safety not guaranteed. Pat loves that movie, but apparently that's based on some other dude's short story.
No offense to Pat, though. Right, Pat's right. Liking in movies is suspect, to say the least. It has been said.
He said it. I think what happened was they had no faith in him. Well, this is ending the trilogy. Talk of oversaturation of Star Wars.
It would be great if Lucas came back in and did it.
Oh, dude, I would love it.
I'd be waiting online right now. Like, we're waiting for episode 8. No, I'm waiting online for episode 9.
Yeah. Fuck 8. No, I'm not knocking the sequel trilogy, but dude, if somehow he pulled out like a Hail Mary and just buys back Lucasfilm,
under the radar director comes in. Yeah. And Sean. All of a sudden, like, they're announcing, we're going to meet this under the radar director. He's coming in via limo right now. Oh. Tour studios, the driver's Rick McCallum.
He's got like a little disguise. You can totally tell it's George Lucas. He's called himself like Luke Georgeson. Oh, that'd be fucking McCallum awesome.
Comes up, is this fucking awesome or what? Yeah.
We're back, bitches. It's me, Rick McCallum.
Brings a Jar Jar doll with the lightning's coming back.
That would be fucking awesome. That would be so awesome. I'm not that into J.J. Abrams, bro. I'm just not. I like The Force Awakens. He did a pretty good job, but it was basically A New Hope redone for new kids. Anyway, I know you got to go, bro. Two more questions. Breakthrough performance. I think I know your answer.
Oh, wow. You're on Greyjoy.
You're on Greyjoy by fucking far, dude. Far and away. Maybe the highlight of the season for me. Speaking of which, my final question, and I'm going to say the same thing, but just give me your top five for season 7. Scenes, performances, whatever it may be. Top five things that you enjoyed about watching season 7 or talking about season 7 or things that happened because of season 7. Top five.
Build up the John and Denny meeting and when John arrives on Dragonstone. What do you think now? Jesus Christ. The ending of Queen's Justice with Jamie's maneuver.
That's going to be on mine. Hell yeah, dude.
The Syrian again shot with the ice dagger, sword, whatever you want to call it. Jamie leaving Cersei and obviously flashback.
Jamie leaving Cersei and the
flashback. John and Aegon.
My top five, I'm going to say to Jamie, because there's a few moments for Jamie where he's acting a little bit like Tywin. The good parts about Tywin, leaving Cersei, how excited he gets when he thinks that they're going to go and help the North fight the others, when he thinks that he has a positive purpose for his life, how happy he seemed. I'm going to say the Hound in the Dragonstone episode. I thought that was some of the best character development that they've had in the entire series, possibly. The Highgarden switch, I'm going to agree with you. I love that sequence. The battle at the Frozen Lake beyond the wall, in particular, not Viserion getting killed, but Viserion waking up with the blue eye. And my favorite thing about season 7 of Game of Thrones, bro, Euron Greyjoy. Pelu, whatever the fuck his name is. Fucking love that guy. I don't want to end it on a negative note. I don't want to say top five things, or bottom five things, rather. Season 7 as a whole. Maybe we'll touch on it again at some point, but I think from here, we're going to go back into a little bit of the book stuff, maybe combining the book stuff and TV stuff. We have a lot of ideas. I think with the natural progression of things, I think maybe a Southern Ambition, Robert's Rebellion series, or maybe combining the two or doing individual series. I think that's a natural way to go. We also talked about maybe characters that weren't in Game of Thrones that could have been and how they could be fit in there. I think that'd be pretty interesting to talk about. Those are the ideas we're kicking around. If you guys have any suggestions or if you like one of those ideas better than the others, by all means, drop us a line on Facebook, facebook.com/thepromiseprincess. Send us a raven. Hit up our Twitter @princespromise. You can find all of our shows, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher app. And when you're there, please, please, please leave a review. We picked up a lot of new listeners with season 7. There's so many fucking Game of Thrones Song of Ice and Fire podcasts out there. It's frustrating. But what I found with most of these podcasts is they're like dudes from Entertainment Weekly or people that like write for Newsweek. It's all not celebrity, but all people in the industry. John and I are fucking middle management. We work hard for a living and we love this stuff. And we love talking about it. We appreciate you guys joining us for season 7. But we got a lot more to say. Click subscribe. Tell a friend. Thank you for listening. We'll speak with you guys next week. At your badge.